So imagine you invest in a business, right? And it consistently earns a 30% return on its capital.
Which is a genuinely staggering number in the public markets.
Exactly. It's massive. And you hold this investment for 20 years. Now, the fundamental mathematics of compounding dictate that you should expect your money to compound at 30%. I mean, turning every single dollar you invested into $23.
Right, that's the logical expectation.
But when you actually look at your brokerage account 2 decades later, your return is closer to 12%. Your dollar didn't turn into 23, it turned into perhaps 9 or 10. So where exactly did the rest of the money go?
Yeah, you pointed to this profound mathematical paradox that really sits right at the center of modern investing.
Right.
We are constantly taught to seek out these highly efficient capital-light businesses, but there is a very strict structural reality to how wealth actually travels from a company's ledger into, your personal portfolio.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are examining a really compelling piece of financial architecture detailed in an article from the Averaging Up collection. This was published in June 2026.
And the piece is titled, Why Visa Earns 30%, But You Get 12%.
Right, and it introduces this analytical concept known as the compounding spread. So our mission today is to really dissect the deep mechanics of compounding. We're going to explore why top-tier companies simply cannot pass their massive internal returns directly to you, the shareholder.
Which sounds like a bad thing at first glance,
But
but.
it's not, right? We're going to see why a 12% return is actually an extraordinary feat of financial engineering rather than some kind of operational failure.
Exactly. We need to step completely away from surface-level metrics for this discussion. We're really unpacking the precise physics of wealth generation here, looking under the hood of what makes a business truly compound capital over decades.
Not just flash a high percentage on a quarterly report.
Right, exactly.
So to understand where that missing 18% of your return disappears to, we first have to analyze the engine that generates the 30% in the first place, and more importantly, the unique structural problem that specific engine creates.
Which the Averaging Up collection defines as the generation rate.
Right, the generation rate. Put simply, this is just what a business earns on its existing operations.
And to ground this in reality, consider Visa as the archetype of what the author terms a free surfer.
A free surfer. I like that term.
Yeah, the business model of a free surfer is essentially a toll on electronic transactions. The generation rate here is exceptionally high because the company's growth is practically free.
Right, because as the external base of transactions grows, as more consumers globally tap their cards or, purchase items online, Visa's revenue expands,
But its internal costs remain practically fixed.
which naturally creates an ever-widening margin. Every new transaction costs them a fraction of a cent to process, so the profit just keeps expanding. But I really want to emphasize a critical point for anyone listening here. Yeah.
That 30% return on invested capital, or ROIC, is not an accounting trick. It's not some paper illusion. The business genuinely converts 30 cents of every single dollar of capital into pure profit year after year.
And when financial analysts cite that figure, and investors bid up the stock price to celebrate it, they are celebrating that generation rate. It is magnificent. But a generation rate that high brings a company to an inevitable logical wall.
Okay, hold on. I'm stuck here. Because if I'm looking at a machine that reliably spits out 30 cents for every dollar I put into it, basic logic dictates I don't just sit on those profits.
Right.
I take every cent of that return and pour it right back into building a second machine. I scale the operation. If the engine is that efficient, why wouldn't Visa just double down and build more of it?
Well, think about the physical constraints of the market they operate in. Let's use a tangible analogy to explain the mechanics of what the article terms the recycling problem.
Imagine you own a highly profitable toll bridge. The steel and concrete are already built. As the population in the surrounding towns grows, the traffic over your bridge naturally increases, and your profits skyrocket.
Sounds like a great business.
It is. But you can't just build a second identical bridge right next to the first one and expect to double your traffic. The regional demand is already being fully serviced by your existing bridge.
Ah, okay. So a second bridge doesn't magically create new cars. It's just redundant infrastructure.
Exactly. Now apply that to Visa's scale. Visa generates roughly $20 billion in free cash flow annually, but the global payment network is already built.
Right.
The vast digital infrastructure connecting banks, merchants, consumers, it's already firmly in place. Processing the next billion digital transactions requires almost zero additional capital from Visa.
Wow.
Therefore, the infrastructure that produces the 30% return fundamentally cannot absorb the cash it produces. The business literally cannot consume its own output.
$20 billion with absolutely nowhere to go. I mean, it sounds like a luxurious problem for a boardroom to have, right? But mathematically, you're saying it creates a massive bottleneck. The engine is too efficient for its own good.
It's a severe drag on overall returns. Because that $20 billion cannot be aggressively reinvested at the original 30% generation rate, it simply sits idle on the balance sheet.
And idle cash earning treasury rates rapidly dilutes the overall return on capital.
Precisely. The business is forced to act. Because the company cannot reinvest that cash back into its core engine, the capital has to exit the building. And the method of that exit is the precise mechanism that creates the gap between the company's headline return and your actual return as a shareholder.
Which brings us to the exit channels. So the cash leaves through two primary mechanisms. First, we have dividends, which currently yield about 1%. That's cash returned directly to your brokerage account. Second, we have share buybacks, which yield roughly 2 to 3%. Now, buybacks retire outstanding shares, which increases the per share value of what remains.
And both of these are forms of capital recycling. The business is converting its operational output into a direct shareholder return. The averaging up collection defines the buyback with, I think, incredible precision. It calls it the purge of the unabsorbable.
The purge of the unabsorbable.
Yeah, it's the necessary mechanism by which the business expels the cash. It simply cannot compound internally.
That fundamentally shifts how you view a stock buyback. I mean, we're so used to hearing buybacks criticized as cynical financial engineering or, you know, executives just trying to boost their bonuses.
Exactly.
But through this analytical framework, it's an exhaust valve for a hyper-efficient machine. It's structural maintenance.
Yeah.
And when we add that 1% dividend to the 2 or 3% buyback, we get a total recycling rate of perhaps 3 to 4%.
Which brings us to the core mathematical concept of this entire framework. The spread. You have a generation rate of 30%. You have a recycling rate on the return capital of 3 to 4%. The spread between those two numbers is roughly 26 percentage points.
I look at that spread as the invisible cost of being capital light. We constantly praise technology and finance companies for not needing heavy capital to grow. But the hidden price they pay for needing no capital is that the enormous cash they produce cannot compound at the rate that originally produced it.
That's spot on.
So what do you actually get? The framework defines your ultimate return as the shareholder blend. You get 10 to 12% organic growth from the expanding external base of global transactions, plus the 2 to 3% from the buybacks and dividends.
And it's crucial to understand why a 12 to 15% blended return is not an indictment of the company's management. It remains an extraordinary outcome in the public markets. That 30% ROIC is not wasted. It's the powerful engine driving that 10 to 12% organic revenue expansion at strictly zero cost. The spread is just the physical reality of what must exit the system to keep the engine running efficiently.
It's a profound shift in perspective. Earning 12% compounded over 20 years on a business with a near certain architectural moat is phenomenal wealth generation. But understanding that this 12% is actually a blend of a 30% engine and a 3% exhaust pipe, it changes how you measure success.
It really does. And this mathematical reality, the persistent spread between generation and recycling, directly challenges one of the most famous adages in investing history.
Oh, wait, you mean Charlie Munger's rule?
Exactly.
Because doesn't this completely contradict his golden rule? We've all been taught his foundational principle. Over the long term, a stock's return converges to the return the underlying business earns on its capital. The classic example Munger gave was that if a business earns 18% on capital over 20 or 30 years, the shareholder will eventually earn a result very close to 18%. If Visa earns 30%, Munger's rule implies I should eventually get 30%. Does the concept of the spread prove him wrong?
It doesn't prove him wrong. But the averaging up collection provides a really vital refinement to his rule.
Okay.
The convergence Munger spoke of is not to the headline ROIC. Your returns do not converge to the 30% generation rate. they converge to the effective compounding rate.
The effective compounding rate, meaning the mathematical blend of the generation rate and the recycling rate weighted by how much capital the business retains versus how much it's forced to return.
Precisely the distinction. A business that earns 30% but returns the vast majority of its cash at 3 to 4% does not converge to 30%. It converges to the blend that 12 to 15%.
Yep, that makes total sense.
Conversely, consider a business that earns 18% but has a massive runway to reinvest all of its profits at that same 18%. That business converges to 18%.
Wow.
So the company with the much lower initial ROIC but the higher recycling capacity can actually deliver a significantly higher absolute return to you than the company with the spectacular ROIC that cannot reinvest its cash.
To make this concrete, let's explore what the article calls the spectrum of spreads. This categorizes businesses based on their architecture of compounding quality.
Let's do it.
We've heavily discussed the first archetype, the free surfer. Think Visa, S&P Global, MSCI. High generation rate of 25 to 35%, but a low recycling rate of 3 to 4%.
Right.
The spread is massive, yielding a predictable 12 to 15%. But what if we look at the opposite? What happens when a company can absorb its own cash?
Then we move along the spectrum to the capital absorber. Consider Google as a current theoretical example, particularly as they navigate the transition to artificial intelligence. A capital absorber might have a slightly lower generation rate, perhaps 20 to 25% on its core search business. However, it has a vastly higher recycling rate, maybe 12 to 20%.
Because it can actually deploy the cash.
Exactly. Because it can deploy tens of billions of dollars into building AI data centers and infrastructure, and ideally earn sustained returns on that massive deployment. The spread is much narrower, which can ultimately yield a shareholder return of 15 to 20%.
But there is a massive risk there, right? I mean, with the free surfer, the toll road is already built. The profits are almost guaranteed as long as commerce continues.
Yes.
With the capital absorber, you're betting that pouring billions of dollars into data centers is actually going to yield a return. If AI monetization falters, their recycling rate collapses, and your blended return completely falls apart.
That's the investor's core dilemma. Every capital allocation decision you make is a judgment about these two rates. Buying a free surfer means you are willingly accepting a wide spread, capping your upside, but in exchange, you're getting structural certainty on the generation rate.
Right.
The 30% engine is highly visible and deeply durable. Buying a capital absorber means you are accepting deep uncertainty on the recycling rate. Betting management can effectively deploy billions in exchange for a narrower spread and a potentially higher ceiling.
And then theoretically, you have the dream business,
The
absolute perfection of compounding, where the generation rate perfectly equals the recycling rate.
The holy grail.
Yeah, the spread is exactly zero. Every single dollar earned is immediately redeployed at the exact same high rate. No leakage, no degradation, no purge required.
It's the theoretical ideal.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, finding a business that can maintain a zero spread at a high rate of return over decades is nearly impossible because capital eventually outgrows the opportunity set.
Yeah.
And finally, on the other end of the spectrum, you have the mediocre business.
Yes, the mediocre business. I think I've accidentally held a few of those in my portfolio over the years.
Haven't we all?
They have an 8 to 10% generation rate and an 8 to 10% recycling rate. The spread is zero, which sounds fantastic on paper, but the reality is they are recycling all that cash just to maintain their existing unimpressive operations.
Yeah.
They're sweating profusely on a financial treadmill, completely exhausted, but not actually moving forward. The compounding is complete, but zero excess wealth is created for the shareholder.
A perfect description.
Yeah.
But let's return to the mechanics of the spread itself, because it does something else entirely. The spread doesn't merely dictate how much return you receive. It entirely dictates when you receive it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it fractures your return as a shareholder into two distinct competing timelines.
This is where the framework gets incredibly analytical. The article introduces the concept of dual duration. It's the structural consequence of owning a business that generates at 30% but can only recycle at 3%.
Right.
That huge gap between those two rates physically forces your return into two entirely different time signatures.
Let's break down those time signatures because this is how the math actually hits your bank account. Time signature one is the purge.
Mm.
This is the short duration component.
Okay.
It consists of the recycled cash from those dividends and buybacks, making up the 3 to 4% of your return. It arrives continuously, quarter after quarter. It is literal cash in hand, And the heavy burden is now on you, the shareholder, to immediately find a new home for it.
And you will almost certainly have to reinvest it at a lower rate of return than the company's internal engine.
Exactly. And then we have time signatures too, which is the wave. This is the long duration component. It is the 10 to 12% organic growth of the business itself,
which you don't actually see in your bank account.
Right. It compounds silently over decades, locked safely inside the economic moat of the company. You don't receive it as cash you can spend today. It is captured purely as future appreciation in the stock price.
To conceptualize how these two forces interact in a single holding, I like to think of it this way. Think of it like holding a portfolio that contains two completely different assets, even though it's just one stock ticker.
Okay, I like where this is going.
The first asset pays you a steady, immediate stream of modest royalty checks in the mail every single quarter. That's your short duration purge. You have to figure out what to do with those checks today.
Right.
The second asset is a trust fund, quietly multiplying in value in the background, completely untouched and unseen, slowly building massive value over 20 years. That is your long duration wave. You hold one stock, but you are receiving two totally different experiences of time and capital.
That analogy captures the dual duration perfectly. Mm. If we synthesize this entire architecture, we see that the dual duration exists because of the spread. If the company could reinvest everything, if it had a zero spread, like our theoretical dream business, nothing would ever exit the building.
The return would be purely long duration.
Precisely.
Yeah.
All value would compound internally, silently.
And conversely, if there was no organic growth at all, if the business was just a static cash cow with zero future expansion, the return would be purely short duration. All the value would exit immediately as cash distributions.
But the free surfer lives precisely between those two extremes. It has both the wave that creates the long component and the spread that creates the short component. The return on invested capital tells you what the internal engine can do.
But the spread tells you what actually survives to arrive in your pocket.
And the dual duration tells you exactly when it arrives.
So let's step back and look at what we've uncovered today. The deep mechanics of compounding reveal that wealth generation is never just one single rate plastered on a financial statement.
Yeah.
It is always two rates. The generation rate and the recycling rate, and the precise mathematical distance between them.
Yeah.
That distance, the spread, explains the paradox of why a company earning 30% only delivers 12% to you. It is not a failure of management. It is the natural physics of a capital-light business purging cash it structurally cannot absorb.
It's an architecture of quality that requires a much more sophisticated analytical lens than simply filtering a database for companies with a high ROIC.
Which brings us to a final provocative thought for you to consider. Look at the companies you consider the absolute crown jewels of your own portfolio, the businesses you hold with deep conviction. Do you actually know what their generation rate is versus their recycling rate?
It's a tough question.
Are you currently paying a premium multiple for a dazzling 30% headline ROIC, completely unaware that the business has absolutely nowhere to efficiently park that cash? Are you holding a free surfer, a risky capital absorber, or perhaps a mediocre business disguised by clever share repurchases?
You have to know the spread.
Understanding the spread might just change how you view every single dollar you have invested. Just like that initial problem we discussed, knowing exactly why your dollar turns into 10 instead of 23 is the key to mastering the true mechanics of compounding. This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com to explore the full collection.